This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Last month, President Biden signed legislation to declare Juneteenth a national holiday. Prior to that, Juneteenth had been recognized by several states across the country, but still remained unknown to many people. To learn more about the holiday and its celebrations, we're joined by James Webb, the owner and president of Indy Juneteenth. Welcome to the program, James. For those who are just now learning about Juneteenth, can you tell us what it is and why it's important?
Well, hello. Thanks for having me, by the way. But Juneteenth is the celebration of the emancipating of all people in the United States of America. It was the day on June 19th in 1865, it was the day when those specific slaves in Galveston, Texas, were informed by General Gordon Granger when he made an announcement in the headquarters of the Confederacy that all people have been emancipated and all slaves that were now free. So it was that day in 1865 that we've been celebrating ever since. Some states got it a little further, like in Kentucky, their date was August 8th. And slavery was on the books in Mississippi all the way until 2003. But technically, June 19th, 1865 is the day we celebrate.
Why is this important for folks to know about? What do you think people should know about it?
Well, because representation matters, and knowing the full story of a certain subject matters as well. I mean, we all enjoy it, like this last weekend, we all enjoyed celebrating the 4th of July. But the truth is that everyone wasn't independent on that day. There were people who looked like myself and my ancestors that were enslaved, and those people just weren't free. And it wasn't until 2.5 years later, on June 19th, 1865, that we were actually given the permission to be free, and that story needs to be heard.
Absolutely. And how has this holiday typically been celebrated before, you know, Biden announced this nationwide? How was it celebrated?
Okay, well, in the past, a way that our ancestors celebrated was that they baked, like, a lot of red velvet cakes. They weren't allowed to have sugar, so one thing that they used was the hibiscus flower, and they used that flower to celebrate and for, like, birthdays and weddings, and they made cakes. So they celebrated it by having red velvet cake. They had and that tradition has been passed down for over hundreds of years. Different families have different recipes. Some do cupcakes.
You know, usually celebrated through, festivals and parties and barbecues. It's your typical, your hamburger, hot dog kind of celebration.
Well, the red velvet cake is making me hungry now, talking about that. So when it comes to the way it was celebrated over the years, and then now it's been federally recognized, does that take away any of the special of the holiday? Do you feel like it's being exploited now?
I think the potential to be exploited can come, but I think the beauty in it is that it's making it inclusive to everyone. It's allowing everyone to join in on the celebration, because one of the hardest things we've been doing for the past 5 years was just educating people on the holiday. But now that it's federal, not everyone knows about the day. Now we can diversify. We can include everyone in the celebration. I do think some people will get on the bandwagon. Some people will try to exploit it to the best of their abilities, but that was going to come anyway. And but now that it's federal, I think the beauty in it will tip the scale a lot more than the exploitation will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I noticed as soon as it was declared a holiday, I go to the store and suddenly there's a bunch of Juneteenth shirts. And I was just wondering, I mean, does that take away from the local community that maybe has already been making shirts like this?
Yes, it does. It does. Like, for my organization, for one, we've been making shirts like this for over 5 years, and we've been celebrating in certain ways for over 5 years. But a lot of people don't know how to get in touch with us, so they're more comfortable going to a Target or a Walmart and purchasing things like that. But it's also opened the doors for us to connect with the Walmarts and the Targets and the Amazons of the world and say, hey, we are a Juneteenth organization, and we do have merchandise and yard signs and flags and things like that for sale that we would love to market with you guys. So that as some doors close, some doors open.
Absolutely, yeah. And can you tell me about, is there a special Juneteenth flag? I feel like I might have seen folks waving different colors in their cars.
Well, Well, yeah, there's some confusion there, a little bit. The flag that people see is the Pan-African flag started by Marcus Garvey, the red, black, and green flag. That is actually not the Juneteenth flag. The Juneteenth flag was started by Ben Haith in, like, the late 80s or early 90s. He created it, and the Juneteenth colors, just like the American flag, are also red, white, and blue. There's a big star in the middle, and that represents the Lone Star State. It's because it started in Texas. And then there's multiple stars surrounding that Lone Star. It represents all of Americans. All of us are all joined together in that one star. And the colors blue represent the waters that we crossed over from the transatlantic slave trade and the rivers we crossed through on the Underground Railroad. And the red represents the blood our ancestors shed during slavery, and the white stands for unity.
Wow, that's very powerful. Thank you for sharing that. I had no idea what those stood for. And when it comes to sort of the federal government recognizing this year, do you know, was there anything that prompted this move? Did this feel like it came out of the blue?
To be honest, no. I feel for when we found out it was a little bit longer, but for 8 minutes and 46 seconds when we watched George Floyd be murdered by a police officer, I think Juneteenth was the day that was used to kind of weaponize, for lack of a better word, black unity. We used that day to come together as a community and celebrate something positive. At the aftermath of watching that horrible transaction between those two adults, it was just something awful to watch. And I think Juneteenth was the medicine that was used to help us kind of get over what we actually saw. So once that happened, I think that lit the match and everything set on fire, went ablaze. Juneteenth kind of crazy a little bit. So because we were prepared for the holiday to, you know, kind of explode. We didn't expect it to grow so fast.
Right, right. And I wonder, you know, with the pandemic and everyone sort of having a moment of quiet and being home, if it made people more aware of Juneteenth and being able to pay attention.
Well, actually, the 2020 was one of our best years. It allowed us to reach, 'cause we had a virtual celebration in 2020. And so, but we were able to reach people in New York City and celebrate with them virtually. We connected with Juneteenth organizations in California and Virginia and Buffalo, New York, and Milwaukee, and all over the country. And it kind of, we kind of like created this union, if you will, of Juneteenth organizations that have been doing this for 5, 10, 15 plus years. And I think that COVID, the COVID year allowed us to, I guess, do the groundwork of spreading the word. And in 2021, we actually were able to physically celebrate.
That's awesome. And when it comes to Juneteenth, I know, because we're talking about Juneteenth, I keep saying Juneteenth. But when it comes to this holiday and it being federally recognized, does this feel like it's enough for the Black community? I mean, obviously, I'm going to say it's not, but what would the next thing be?
Well, it's not enough. And even as a Juneteenth, as an individual who owns a Juneteenth nonprofit organization, I would think they kind of skipped a few steps. Like, we would have much rather had an anti-lynching bill be passed than for Juneteenth to be a federal holiday. We would have much rather have had, you know, our school systems be funded differently than just property taxes in low-income communities. We would have loved to have more things, more grocery store food deserts. We would have loved to have more grocery stores in our Black communities than to have Juneteenth be a federal holiday. So there's still more work to do. We would have loved to get to inform more Black people on the importance of participating in the census. And how that affects our communities. We would have loved those things to have happened first, but we kind of take what you can and you keep running, you know, and you keep on fighting toward equality, and you keep on fighting for diversity and inclusion. And Juneteenth was one of the things that fell from the tree, and we're glad that it's there, because that deserved to happen as well.
Mm-hmm. And with Indie Juneteenth, you do this event every year, or are there any other events that you hold?
Well, we do events all throughout the year. Right now, we're getting ready for our back to school, Indy Juneteenth back to school parade. That'll be happening Labor Day weekend. We're having our first annual Indy Juneteenth Awards, where we'll be thanking educators and community organizers and people who do community service throughout the year. We do our food drives in November, and we do our clothing drives in December. We take our educational museum trips every year. We had to cancel due to COVID last year, but we were going to go to the Muhammad Ali Center in Louisville, but we had to cancel that, so hopefully we can do that again. And this year, we were able to crown the first Miss Juneteenth in the state of Indiana, and that's a scholarship pageant where we were able to give away $2,500 scholarship to the winner and a $500 scholarship to the runner-up. Because one thing unbeknownst to a lot of people, that Miss Juneteenth celebrations are huge with Juneteenth culture. So we were proud to be able to bring that to the state of Indiana for the first time.
Wow, you got a lot going on.
Oh, yeah. We're like we say, Juneteenth 365. We're a traditional nonprofit organization, and we do things year round.
That's awesome. And so for folks that are tuning in and want to know how to get involved or to participate, where should they go?
They can follow us on Facebook at Indy Juneteenth. They can follow us on Instagram at Indy Juneteenth, or they can go to our website, IndyJuneteenth.com, and just follow us. And we're always looking for volunteers. We're always looking for sponsors. We're always looking for charitable donations. And we're also looking to partner with other people. And we like to do community service as well. My wife and I started this nonprofit organization, yes, for Juneteenth, but also because we're both a service to our community and we're always willing to help out where we can.
James Webb is the owner and president of Indy Juneteenth. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Coming up after the break, we'll hear from a mother in South Bend who's been working hard over the years to find the right service providers for her son as we talk about children's mental health. Still to come later in the show, we'll also discuss a nonprofit in Indiana working to raise awareness about abuse and exploitation of seniors and adults with disabilities. If you have any questions or comments for the show, you can always let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam So, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. We're talking today about cases of abuse and exploitation of seniors and endangered adults in Indiana. We love your questions and comments on the topic. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. You can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Send us your question or comment, and we'll try to get it onto the show. With us again are Jessica Brock, staff attorney and project director of the LAVA Project at Indiana Legal Services, and Courtney Sweat is an attorney at Indiana Legal Services. Before the break, we were talking a little bit about the LAVA Project, and I'm curious to know, why did you feel the need that you had to have a project targeted at this specific group of folks? Is there a lack of support right now in Indiana for people in these situations?
There's definitely a lack of support in Indiana and frankly across the nation. The LAVA Project is one of the first of its kind in the United States. Now there's more projects like ours, but when we started in January of 2017, there were few projects exactly like ours. But the need came. Dennis Frick, who's an attorney at Indiana Legal Services and directs our senior law project, has a lot of experience working with older adults and had seen cases of abuse in his legal career and had wanted to do something intentional to address elder abuse. And about that time, the Indiana Criminal Justice Institute that funds our project along with Equal Justice Works, said that we have this funding available. Do you have a project you would like to put together? And the front page of the Indianapolis Star had this huge article on how adult protective services in the state of Indiana needs more resources and support. So the idea, Dennis had this great idea to form a project that would address elder abuse, but also help support the clientele of adult protective services by making our project also available. Anyone, an endangered adult is the legal title given to someone who's eligible for adult protective services. So anyone who works with adult protective services is eligible to be one of our clients. So we're able to address elder abuse while also supporting the clientele of adult protective services, both very vulnerable and often overlooked populations in our state.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I would say from my understanding now, learning about all of this, it seems like it's overlooked because we don't often think of adults as being in need of help. We think of children, right? Is anything being done to change that aside from the project that you're doing? Any awareness campaigns or anything, Courtney?
Yeah, there are a ton of ongoing trainings that programs like the National Center on Elder and Law Rights does, and as well as Equal Justice Works is also pushing trainings and information about elder abuse. And I think that it's just a topic, like you said, that a lot of people don't think about an adult needing those kinds of services. And they typically think that an adult is perfectly capable and able to defend themselves and protect themselves in these kinds of situations. And I think it just speaks a lot to the fact that there's sometimes shame that is imposed on individuals where they feel ashamed that they've been taken advantage of, or the advantage is being taken by their adult child or family members. So they don't want to report them because there's a whole other family dynamic there of causing disturbances in the family peace. So it's difficult for a lot of those individuals to either have the ability or the courage to be able to reach out and ask for help. And I think by being one of those additional resources to adult protective services, it offers adult protective services an option to be able to provide their clientele, like, hey, here's a resource. I understand that you're feeling this way and you have concerns about reaching out, but even sometimes if they don't want to pursue criminal charges against their child, they may still be willing to pursue the civil cause. They may not want them to go to jail, but they still want some sort of justice. And I think that our project is a good bridge to that gap. And I think it is empowering a lot of citizens across our state to be able to stand up for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Now, if an individual is facing exploitation or abuse from either a family member or a guardianship or something like that, how would they report it? Is there somebody that's systematically checking in on them, or is this a case where they would have to find the resources on their own?
Well, everyone in the state of Indiana is a mandatory reporter of elder abuse or abuse. So if you witness or know of abuse of an adult, you are required by law to report that to Adult Protective Services or local law enforcement. And APS or local law enforcement will investigate the report. All reports are anonymous. So that's one tool. We have ombudsmen in our facilities in the state of Indiana advocating for the rights of folks who live there. They are another resource if someone is facing exploitation or abuse in a facility setting. We get a lot of referrals from area agencies on aging and councils on aging who often provide transportation to older adults. They might come in for meals and in conversation, maybe a romance scam comes up in conversation, or a bad roofing situation, or a relative who won't let them leave the house without permission or takes their mail. So mm-hmm. they get connected with us. We also get a number of reports from financial institutions, the fraud departments at banks. We've done trainings with them, and they help identify accounts that are overdrawn and bring those to the account holders' attention and help connect them to us. Law enforcement, some prosecutors, have partnered with us. We're hoping to get in with medical providers because that's one place where we believe those who are experiencing abuse would be in a safe and private setting to be able to say in confidence to, you know, the nurse or the doctor, hey, you know, I need some help while we're in this room, just the two of us. Can you find me some help, whether that's alerting APS, calling law enforcement, calling us. So there are a number of ways people can connect. And we're very excited about this. I wish it was ready today to say, go do it now. But we're working on developing an online, it's called the Legal Risk Detector. And it's basically like WebMD for legal problems. So people, when they have the link, will be able to go to that website, and it's a self-guided, you answer questions about housing issues and financial exploitation, access to housing, domestic violence, different topics. And at the end of completing it, the risk detector tells you whether or not you seem to be at risk, that you have, you know, some kind of legal issue. And from there, the person will be given a list of resources, but also has the option of generating a referral to us to apply for legal assistance. So we're hoping that that will be a useful tool to folks once we get it up and running later this year.
Well, so you guys have a lot of systems in place. It's really impressive to hear about all of this expansion. When it comes to the cases that you receive, Courtney, is there a sense for how many cases of abuse or exploitation are actually reported versus those that aren't?
I believe Jessica has more specific statistics, but I would say that there's a large majority are not reported. And I think that goes towards a lot to do with, you know, as I said, family conflict or just the shame that they've been taken advantage of, or the fact that they feel like they've already been through so much. Why would they want to drag themselves through the court system and put themselves through even more trauma? Jessica, can you recall the top of your head the statistics?
Sure. So the estimates are that 1 in 9 or 1 in 10 older adults suffer abuse, neglect, or exploitation. And that's a national estimate. Mm-hmm. And I would assume that the statistic is right around there in Indiana. And frankly, when I started working in this project, when I heard that statistic, I thought that really just, I thought maybe that was over exaggerated. But I tell you, talking to family and friends when they ask me what I do for a living, just in conversation, I've not had a single person who hasn't had a story, either personally or a coworker or someone they know, of a family member who has been the victim of a scam or taken advantage of by a relative. So I'm actually kind of thinking that that statistic may be understating the problem. And, you know, in addition to the harm that the abuse does itself, it's also a major health factor for older adults. Seniors who are abused, neglected, or exploited are at 3 times the risk of death. It has a major toll on their health going through these cases and going through the abuse. So it's not just a legal problem. It really is a public health problem as well. And then the other estimate is that only 1 in 24 of these cases are reported to authorities. And as Courtney said, a lot of that is to do with shame. So many clients tell us that they feel stupid or that they should have known better, or how could they have trusted someone? And we're hoping by letting folks know that this is unfortunately a pervasive problem. You're not alone. These scammers, I mean, it's their business. They are in the business of scamming, and they're really good at it. They're really good at making it look legitimate, or they wouldn't be in business. And to let them know that there's a free resource. We are free. We are confidential. As Courtney said earlier, you know, no one's going to jail automatically if you call us. So if you just want to know if the situation you're in is a problem, what your options might be, and you want to leave it at that, we're happy to provide that advice so that the person can make a more informed decision. We just want people to know that there are safe resources available for anyone who finds themselves in such a terrible position.
Mm-hmm. And we mentioned earlier, we were talking a little bit about the shame and the stigma that maybe gives people pause to report or talk about this. Courtney, is there anything, I mean, aside from these awareness campaigns or letting people know that they're not alone, is there anything that would get people to be more comfortable, or let's say our listeners are wondering how they can help someone if they suspect something like this is going on?
I think the biggest thing you can do is have a conversation with that individual away from whoever that person thinks is abusing them. That conversation is so important because while we are here to offer protection for individuals, we also don't want to take away their rights. So if they choose to not do anything about a situation, they are adults who have the right to make that decision. And if they don't want to proceed in any legal form, then they should not be forced to do so. So I think just having a conversation with them in a safe environment where it can be done privately without the knowledge of the abuser, I think is where you have to start. And then helping that individual in any way you can, if they do alert you that they would like to seek further assistance, whether that's helping them get to the police department to make a police report if they want to, or helping them get online and submit an application for services with ILS, or helping them get out of the house so that they can make a phone call to us to be able to submit an application. A lot of our clients do end up being confined to their home and they don't necessarily have a way to get out and about to be able to go and seek help. Or because we work with elderly individuals, you know, it's common for those individuals to not have access to internet or have a cell phone to be able to use. So that way, the only way they can make a phone call is within the home in front of the abuser, if the abuser lives with them, or having to somehow find an internet connection to be able to search for resources. So just being a guide for them and being another resource for them to be able to access those resources that they may not be able to get to, whether it be just mobility issues or it's just the abuser prevents them from being able to get access to those things.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jessica, when it comes to the scammers, you mentioned a couple times about how scammers take advantage of older adults. Is help for folks who have been scammed, is it only for people of a certain age range, you know, like senior citizens, or can anybody get help?
In our project, the person would need to be an older adult, 60 or older, or fit into the endangered adult category. And if they fall into the endangered adult definition, the person can be 18 years or older. One of the sort of threshold, it's not the only requirement, but a sort of baseline requirement to fall into the endangered adult category is to have some sort of disability. But if you're unsure whether we can provide assistance, we definitely encourage you to apply. The worst we can say is you don't qualify or we're unable to help. There are other resources available at the state, and national levels. Folks are encouraged to make reports to the Indiana Attorney General and their Consumer Division if they fall prey to a scam or a bad business practice. You can make reports to the Better Business Bureau. Nationally, you can make reports to the Federal Trade Commission and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and they have great resources on identity theft and helping folks walk out of that situation. So there are some other state and federal resources, but they are more giving information and helping to report rather than helping on an individual case-by-case basis. That's a different kind of resource.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that you handle more scammer-type cases than other things with the rise of the internet and all of these things that look so real, or is it pretty similar?
They seem to come in waves for reasons we'll never understand. Sometimes it's scam month, and sometimes it's guardianship month, and sometimes it's roofing month. We had a lot of scams, I would say, towards the beginning of our project. I've seen a decline in them. There's limited help that we can provide in a scam situation. Ordinarily, money out is money gone. because most of the scammers are international, difficult to locate, and so therefore difficult to sue. We have been able to get some relief for folks who sent money in a scam via wire transfer.
Thank you to both of you so much for joining us. Jessica Brock is a staff attorney and project director of the LAVA Project at Indiana Legal Services, and Courtney Sweat is an attorney at Indiana Legal Services. Coming up, we'll hear from a mother in South Bend who's been working for years to get help for her son. And if you have any questions or comments, you can always reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're discussing children's mental health during the pandemic, and with us is a mother from South Bend who's been working for years to try to find the right providers for her son. Meg Hartz, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. You were featured recently in a story by Carter Barrett for Side Effects Public Media. Can you talk about what your personal connection is with these issues around mental health?
So I have a 16-year-old son who was diagnosed at 9 years old with bipolar disorder. And since that diagnosis, we have been plunged into the world of mental health care and the lack of mental health care in our area and just all the difficulties of accessing that care for him. It's been a very long and very arduous journey, trying to make sure that he gets the help that he needs.
Mm-hmm. And so you said from when he was 9 years old, have you seen things change in those years up to now? Have things gotten easier to navigate?
Perhaps they've gotten easier for me to navigate because I know what kind of the keywords are and what to Google. When my son was first diagnosed, we were told that we needed wraparound services, as you just talked about with the representatives from Aspire. I had no idea how to access wraparound services, and it sounds great that they have so much access down in Indy, but up here in South Bend, there is only one place to access wraparound services, and that place only takes Medicaid clients. So we were out of luck for 4.5 years.
Oh, wow. So you're saying South Bend is kind of isolated from other parts of the state in terms of having access to things.
It does seem that way. My son is currently in an inpatient and residential care. And as we were switching from inpatient to residential care, we had to look at facilities all across the state because funding is also another huge barrier to access. We do have private insurance. We do have funds as a family. We're not super wealthy, but we've been blessed with solid rewards for our hard work, which everybody else cannot say. So when we were trying to find a residential facility, there were very few that took insurance, and those that did take insurance required my son to have had 2 failed inpatient care stays before they would accept him, and he did not have those. So getting him into the facility that he is now, there were many barriers to, not only did you have trouble finding the facility, but then once you found them, trying to get in and match their criteria was also very difficult.
And, you know, I thank you so much for sharing this. I really appreciate it. And I'm just wondering, though, when it comes to insurance, we kind of talked about this a little bit in the earlier segments, just how insurance doesn't always cover these things. It seems like most people don't know that, you know, I mean, until they actually have to go and use their insurance and find out that it's not covered. What was that like for you finding that out?
Well, we've hit it on both sides. We've had, when my son was first diagnosed, there were only 2 pediatric psychiatrists within 100 miles of our house. One took insurance and one did not. When we went to find wraparound services, what we discovered is that the places that we went to look for did not take insurance. So it almost didn't matter whether our insurance covered something or not, because the places that offered those services didn't take insurance. So we ended up spending a lot of money out of pocket in order to get him the care that he needs. In fact, the place that he's at now does not take insurance, and we had to petition for funding through the state just so that he could stay in the facility where everybody recommended that he stay. Mm-hmm. So we had his therapist, the psychiatrist, everybody was on board saying this is what he needs, but they wouldn't take insurance. I couldn't even pay by cash. So it's not a question of whether only the wealthy get access. We're not wealthy, but we couldn't even, you know, beg, borrow, and steal access that way. You had to get it through either the probation system. My son is not a criminal, so that was not a viable option, or DCS. My son is not abused or neglected, so that's not a viable option. You can go through the state. Most of the time, you have to relinquish your parental rights in order to access care through the state. And we were not willing to go in that direction. So it was very difficult to find funding, even when we had the ability to pay, but no place would still take him.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like there's definitely a need to sort of revisit all of these rules or things that have been put in place, because it sounds extremely difficult.
It is very difficult.
Well, what about, when you mentioned the matching criteria to get into a facility, is part of that there isn't enough space and there aren't enough resources for folks who need to use these facilities? Or was it all just about, I don't know, some kind of trying to deter people so they don't have to take too many people?
It could be a little bit of both. I think that we're in a catch-22 in the sense that in order for a child or teen, or I'm assuming adult, can get into emergency services, either a hospitalization or an inpatient, they either have to be referred there by probation or DCS or the courts, or they have to be violent, which means they have to be actively suicidal or homicidal. While we all profess to say that just because a person is mentally ill does not mean that they are violent, when it comes to accessing care, there are a lot of barriers if you are not violent. Your only sure ticket into accessing care is if you are suicidal or homicidal. So my son, even when he was in crisis, we would take him to the area ER or the area emergency psychiatric facility, and they would say, yes, you are right, your son is in crisis, but he's not suicidal or homicidal, so just take him home and call your psych in the morning. So you can't get those two inpatient or hospitalizations unless they are suicidal or homicidal, and my son is violent. So ironically, if you're not violent, they don't consider you in crisis. It didn't really matter if he was manic and awake for 5 days in a row and just needed to sleep, or if he was so depressed he couldn't engage at all in life. Those didn't seem to be crises because he wasn't hurting anybody but himself. So we did not get access to any emergency care that way. And then finally, when he was so ill that he was put inpatient, we couldn't access residential care for him because of those two. We didn't have the two previous inpatient or hospitalizations because he wasn't violent. And it's a huge catch-22. And I know that it is a huge, there's a huge lack of services out there. There's just not enough beds for all the people that need beds. So I understand that they have to barriers and criteria up. But at the same time, we need to be practicing some preventive care here. And if we are insisting that all of our mentally ill children become suicidal or homicidal, to me, that's almost the same as if they if your kids had cancer and you said, well, you can only access treatment when it gets to stage four. We understand that they have cancer and that sucks for them. It is life threatening, but we're going to wait until stage four and then we'll have a bed. That's essentially what they're doing to the mentally ill is, yeah, that is a horrible situation to be in. That can be life threatening, but we're going to wait until it actually is life threatening before we let you in. And that's kind of been our experience.
Right. Well, we do have a comment from a listener on Facebook. I'm going to let you know what they say. Tarina on Facebook says, as a waiver case manager and a foster parent, I'm quite aware of what services are out there. However, actually getting the services is a whole other thing, especially when there is a child with intensive behavioral needs. There are so many families in true crisis due to the level of their children's needs, and there's often nothing available to support them. Staff don't want to work with highly aggressive people for low pay, so families are never able to get a break and regroup. It's heartbreaking and a tremendous strain on their families. These families love their child but desperately need a break. We as a state need to do better.
Oh, absolutely. Well, my son has behavior has not necessarily been violent. It has been very trying when he has not gone to school for days upon days upon days, and you worry that you know he has been so depressed and not getting out of bed, you can't leave him alone because you're afraid that what if he is suicidal. Mm-hmm. You know, we are requiring our kids not only to be suicidal but to tell someone that they are, and that's a whole different level that you have to admit that not only are you suicidal, but you have to express that to someone whom you don't know. That's a really high bar. Mm-hmm. And we're asking a little too much of our kids for that, to require that of them. And yeah, I don't mean to be sounding as if I think that people who are violent or people who are dealing with kids who have violent behavioral issues aren't struggling or anything like that. It's just that it's almost as if those cases are obvious, and it's awful that we are not doing anything for what should be obvious, but we are also failing cases that are not obvious.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you, as a parent dealing with something like this, how would you talk to someone who is hearing this struggle and now is just like, well, now I don't know if I should even bother trying to get access because it sounds so difficult.
What I have actually told other parents is be persistent. It's worth fighting for and be persistent, but it's not easy. And I do know a lot of parents, not a lot, but I do know parents who have given up. Because accessing the care that their child needs is too hard. And so they give up and they wait until the kid becomes 18. And then the kid is someone else's problem. I wish that I had some magic formula for accessing care. I tell folks, get on the wait list. Every place has a wait list. Put your name on every single one of them. I'm sure the people in the facilities hate for me to say that because, you know, it just makes their wait lists longer. But we have never had a wait list less than 6 months for any of the services that my son has been able to access. And wraparound, we waited 4.5 years for. So it's hard. It's not an easy journey.
Mm-hmm. And from your experience over these years, do you think that the stigma around mental health is changing at all, or is there still a lot of work to be done?
I do believe that the stigma around it is changing slightly, not as fast as I would like it to, but there is a lot more awareness. You see on posts on Facebook, or you see campaigns about getting help. It's not that there's no shame in getting help. There's the Stop the Stigma campaign. It's okay to talk about it. But on the other hand, we have all of these campaigns about eliminating the stigma. But at the same time, you know, we had the shooting in Indianapolis at the FedEx facility. And the first thing that was reported about the shooter was that he had mental illness. And that puts all of the folks who have mental illness right back into being stigmatized. People are scared of them because they are mentally ill. Even though the mentally ill are much more likely to be victims of violence than perpetrators. So we have a long way to go, but I do believe that the stigma is lessening, but the way things are handled in the media is not helpful. And again, requiring that aspect of violence in order to access care only perpetuates the idea that if you are mentally ill, you are violent. Mm-hmm. If we require our folks who are battling mental illness to actually be violent against themselves or others before they can access emergency care, then we are saying, essentially, you must be violent in order to be, I don't know, bad enough off to deserve care. And that's an awful thing to tell someone.
Right. And I know some of what we talked about in the earlier segments, there's a lack of service providers as well. So I wonder if that kind of complicates things too, just like this trickle effect from not enough service providers to needing things to be at a certain escalation. So it sounds like there's a lot of stuff that needs to be worked on.
Absolutely. And I firmly believe that we do have a serious issue with our service providers. Not just from the lack of having them, but as you talked about in the previous section about burnout, if I kind of go back to that not great analogy of you know, only taking the people with stage 4 cancer, if you are a doctor and only see patients at the worst of the worst and you can save only a few of them, how disheartening and difficult that job is. If you don't get to see the people who you caught that disease early, that you discovered a screening process that could save all these lives, you know, that's a much more heartening place to come from and serve from. Whereas we are giving only the hardest cases, only the most severe, only the most difficult to our service providers, because those are the only ones that can make it through. And of course, our service providers are exhausted. I'm exhausted from dealing with my son for 4.5 years, and he's my son, and I love him, and I do everything for him, but it's exhausting. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine being a service provider who has to deal with, you know, 10 to 100 clients just like him. That's got to be hard.
Right. Well, I want to thank you so much, Meg, for taking the time to talk with us and opening up about what you're going through. Meg Hartz is a mother in South Bend. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.